The bricks were red, the sky was brilliant blue, the knots in the barbed wire sparkled like ladies' earrings. A yellow bird landed on a curlicue of wire, stayed for a moment, and flew off. We came to a gate in the wall. The guard opened it. We marched through. The jackboots stayed behind. One of them bowed deeply. I didn't understand that he was mocking us. I bowed back. He kicked me in the rear end and sent me sprawling to the ground. The gate slammed shut. I made a beeline for the Milgrams' apartment. When Janina opened the door, I announced, "I live in the ghetto now." "Just what we need," said Uncle Shepsel, "another neighbor." I didn't see Janina's mother and father. "Where are your parents?" Janina told me that her father had been taken out of the ghetto and out of the city on a work detail. Her mother was sewing uniforms for jackboot soldiers in a Warsaw factory. Only people with work permits were allowed through the gates in the wall.
"Let's go outside," I said.
We bolted from the apartment and ran down the stairs, Uncle Shepsel shouting, "Wear your armband!" It was cold and bright outside. We ran about the courtyard like let-loose puppies. Uncle Shepsel's voice came down from the window, "Your armband!" We ran out to the street. "Why don't you wear your armband?" I said to Janina. "Why don't you?" she said. "I'm not a Jew." "Well, I'm just a little girl. Who cares about a little girl?" She twirled about. "Besides, we live in the ghetto now. We're safe." We ran down the street. To my eyes, this side of the wall looked very much like the other side. Crowds of noisy people. Even the fox furs riding the shoulders of the rich lady seemed as if they might speak at any moment. Everywhere we went, people were selling things, calling out, "Mirror, mirror, unbroken! Beautiful pictures, 3 for the price of 1. Toys, toys, hairbrush, cheap." I saw a boy with one arm. "Oleg!" I cried out. We ran to him. Oleg squinted at us, shading his eyes with his one hand.
"Oleg has one arm," I said to Janina.
She punched me. "I can see." She turned to Oleg. "What happened to your arm?" Oleg looked down at his right shoulder. For a moment, he seemed surprised to find the arm was gone. He frowned. "Train," he said at last. Janina reached out. "Don't be sad. This one is good." "This is Janina Milgram," I announced proudly. "She's my sister." It just came out. Oleg looked at her, but he did not smile. We all looked at each other for a while, then went our separate ways. Later we saw gray, unspeaking John. He was sitting on the sidewalk, his back against the ripped wall of a bombed-out building. "Hello, John," I said. John did not seem to hear me. His eyes were closed. "He's sleeping," Janina whispered. Just then one of John's eyes fluttered open. "This is Janina Milgram," I said. Janina held out her hand. "Hello." The eye closed. I whispered in her ear, "He doesn't talk." Janina pulled me away. "Let him sleep," she said. I raised my voice as if he were far away. "She's my sister." As we walked away, I said, "John is gray. He's sick." Janina said, "Why do you tell them I'm your sister? I'm not your sister." I shrugged. I didn't know. Before we got back to Niska Street, we heard squeals and shouts down an alley. A knot of children was writhing on the ground. Suddenly one of them, a boy, popped out of the knot and came running toward us. As he sped by, I could see that he clutched a potato in his hand. Some of the other children raced after him. The rest dragged themselves off down the alley. Janina looked at me. "What happened?" "Unlucky orphans," I said. I told her that was what Inez called them. Orphans who did not live in Dr. Korchak's home or any other, and who roamed the streets hungry and begging and sick. "Be glad we're not unlucky orphans," I told her. "Is Gray John an unlucky orphan?" she said. "Oh, no," I said. "He's a lucky one. He's with us." 18. Winter. Uri had found us by our first morning inside the wall. By now we saw even less of him. "Do you go to the other side?" I asked him. "Do you have a work permit?"
Don't ask, he said.
One cold day, Uri and I were on the street. I was wearing two coats, but I could not make my feet warm. There were many people. I saw a boy, at least I thought it was a boy from his size. He was lying on the sidewalk. I wondered how he could sleep with all the noise and people. It was very strange. He was not in a doorway, where I had often seen people sleeping. He was not even on the edge of the sidewalk. He was right in the middle. The people just walked around him, making the shape of an eye. It was also strange that although no one seemed to see him, no one tripped over him. But the strangest thing of all was the newspaper. It covered him like a blanket.
Uri, I said, that boy is stupid. The newspaper can't keep him warm.
Nothing can keep him warm, said Uri. He's dead. We were stopped, looking down at the dead boy, the only ones not walking by.
Why is he dead?
I said.
Did a jackboot shoot him?
Uri shrugged. Maybe. Or no food, or the cold, or typhus. Take your pick.
What's typhus?
A sickness.
Very popular.
Unlucky orphan.
Yeah.
He pulled me along.
From then on, I saw dead people under newspapers every day. It was easy to tell the children. Only one page was needed to cover them. One day I asked Uri, why are they covered with newspaper?
So nobody can see them.
But I can see them, I said.
Uri did not answer.
Then I saw one of them become seen by a man. He stopped in front of one. He put his foot on top of the humped newspaper and tied his shoe. The same bodies were never there 2 days in a row, but there were always new bodies in new places. Sometimes the feet were sticking out from the newspaper. In the first days, the feet always had shoes. Then they stopped having shoes. Then the socks were gone. In the nights, I wondered who put the newspapers over the bodies and who took the bodies away. I thought, angels.
XIX.
The boys and I, we slept in the rubble. We did not have a blanket, but we did have a round braided rug. We all slept together under it. But that wasn't our main blanket. Our main blanket was ourselves. We slept with our arms around each other, our noses pressed into each other's necks. Enos called it trading lice. If anybody farted, he was kicked outside the rug. When Uri was with us, I slept next to him. Many nights he wasn't there. I wondered where he was, but he had said don't ask, so I didn't ask. We were huddled kittens, the bunch of us. We were voices in the dark. Often we talked about mothers. Though I could not remember mine, I had a pretty good idea what a mother was. Not Ferdy. He was always saying, I don't believe in them.
Where do you think you came from? Said Enos one night under the rug. An elephant?
Who do you think are all those ladies holding children's hands? Said Oleg.
Fakes, said Ferdy, whose answers were never long. He blew more smoke than words.
Everybody has a mother, said Kuba. Everybody.
Orphans, said Ferdy. Whenever he spoke, you could smell his cigar breath.
Orphans had mothers too, dummy, said Enos. They're dead, that's all.
Real mothers don't die, said Ferdy. No one had an answer to that. So we talked about oranges. Like mothers, oranges were a common topic. Enos said he had eaten them many times, but Ferdy said they were only made up.
What do oranges taste like? I asked Enos.
He closed his eyes. Like nothing else.
What do they look like?
Like a little sun before it sets.
Ferdy said, oranges don't exist.
In the morning light, most of us would begin to believe in mothers and oranges again. But for now, under the rug in the pitch blackness, hearing the faint sounds of the city on the other side of the wall, Ferdy had given us doubts. Each morning we crawled up out of the rubble and onto the streets. Sometimes we stayed together, but mostly we went our own ways. In a group, we were more of a target for the flops who were the ghetto police. We had no armbands, no identification papers, no records. Nothing. "We don't exist," said Ferdy under the rug one night. Enos's voice came. "Tell that to my stomach." Enos wasn't the only one. All of us were hungry. This was something new. Until now, we had simply taken what we needed to eat. All of Warsaw had been our food market. Even in the ghetto at first, there had been food for the taking, for quick hands and feet. But now, after months of winter, we were finding our hands and our stomachs empty. Ladies no longer walked down the street with loaves and paper bags. Bakers didn't bake, as there was no flour. There were shops here and there, but the shelves were mostly empty. Where there was a morsel of food on a shelf, there was someone standing in front of it, often with a club in his hand. Uri came with food sometimes, a jar of molasses, a turnip. When he brought chewing gum, we chewed the sugar out of it, then swallowed it whole. Uri said, "They're starving us." "Why?" I said. "To get rid of us, to kill us," said Enos. "Why don't they just shoot us?" I said. Enos snickered, "Save money on bullets." In the beginning, there were horses in the ghetto, but then they began to disappear. Sometimes parts of them reappeared on Ganshia Street. Ganshia Street became an outdoor market. It was known that if you had food to sell, that was where you went. People stood on the sidewalk in the snow. Resting on an upturned crate or school desk would be the shank of a horse, or a side of dog or cat, a box of salt, a licorice stick, an onion, a potato or two. The vendors hugged themselves against the cold and cried out, "Fat here! Nice goose fat! 20 zlotys! Bones, bones, crack the bones, lots of marrow! Pigeon! Squirrel! Dog! Dog! Best offer!" At first the animals appeared in the market in their feathers or fur, as naturally dead as the foxes that some of the ladies still wore about their shoulders. Then, if they had fuel for fire, the vendors began to skin and pluck and roast them. The carcasses were laid out, blackened and crusty and minus their heads, and the vendors' cries went out, and the prices went up. One day I walked along Ganshia Street with Enos. The smells of the roasted animals made my mouth water. I hadn't eaten since the day before. Men with clubs stood by the displays of food. Flops walked the street. Enos himself seemed not hungry, but playful. He wiggled down the street and fluttered his fingers and made his voice high and fancy like a fox fur lady's and said, "Oh yes, that's lovely. I'll have that entire goose," pointing at a bird no bigger than a sparrow. "And that fine squirrel, 1/2 pound of that, please, and that nostril of horse." I was laughing at Enos, and the men with the clubs were swatting at us, telling us to move on. And then I looked at Enos's face. And suddenly I knew he wasn't playing after all. He winked at me. I grabbed 2 sparrow-sized birds from under a falling club, and the both of us ran till we couldn't hear the screams behind us. In time, there were no more birds and dogs along the Ganshia Street market, but the vendors never seemed to run out of squirrel. Soon everybody knew why. The charred, headless, tailless bodies laid out on the crates were not squirrels at all. They were rats. But the cry of the vendors never changed. "Squirrel! Squirrel!" One day, on my own, I snatched 2 roasted rats. I ate one myself and took the other to Janina's house. I kept the rat in my pocket so no one would take it from me. Only Janina and Uncle Shepsel were home. Mr. Milgram was off at the work camp, as usual. Mrs. Milgram was at her job at the jackboot uniform factory. I took the rat from my pocket and held it by one leg for them to see. "I brought you a squirrel," I said. Uncle Shepsel laughed. "Not only do you smell, you're stupid," he said between laughs. "That," he flicked it, and it swung from its leg between my fingers, "is a rat." Janina took it from me. She made a face at Uncle Shepsel. "It's a squirrel. I'll save it for Mama and Tata."
Uncle Shepsel coughed. He looked around for somewhere to spit, then spit on the floor. Janita punched his arm. Tata said don't do that. Spit out the window. Uncle Shepsel said, your mother and father know a rat when they see one. They won't eat it. Janita stomped her foot. It's a squirrel. They will. They're hungry. So am I, said Uncle Shepsel, and snatched the rat from her hand. Janina grabbed for it, and now they both had it. Janina pulling on the tiny front legs, Uncle Shepsel on the back. They grunted and scowled at each other. The rat came apart in the middle. Janina staggered backward onto her rear end. By the time she got up, Uncle Shepsel was munching on his half. She tried to reach it, but he was too tall. He kept swatting her away with his free hand as he finished off his meal. I was there when Janina's mother came back from her job. I saw the delight on her face when Janina said, Mama, food! And I saw the look change when she saw what it was. When Mr. Milgram came in, he looked at the little half-carcass and shook his head sadly and said, No, not yet. He went to the mattress and lay down with Mrs. Milgram. Janina started to cry. She threw the rat on the floor and kicked it at Uncle Shepsel. Uncle Shepsel picked it up. I left then as he was brushing floor dirt from the rat. The next day, I began walking along the wall. Until then, I had not thought much about the other side. Now I thought, there's food over there, more than rats. The gates in the wall were guarded by jackboots and flops. The wall was much too high to climb over, and even if I could get to the top, there was the thicket of barbed wire and broken glass. All that day, I walked and looked. At last I saw something. It was not far from the uniform factory. There was a break in the bricks. It was low enough for me to reach. It was two bricks wide. I didn't know it then, but it was a drain hole of some sort. It would never occur to them that anyone could squeeze through a space two bricks wide. I left then and came back after dark. I was through the hole in a second. I stood on the other side. 20. I expected to come back with so much food, I'd have to push it one item at a time through the two brick hole. But all I could find was a jar of fish chunks. As I squeezed back through the hole, the jar fell and broke. I picked up the chunks, brushed off the dirt, ate one, and stuffed the rest into my pockets. I went straight to the Milgrams. Uncle Shepsel gave his usual greeting. Ah, the smelly one. It was dark outside, but there was electricity this night. A single light bulb dangled from a cord in the ceiling. Mrs. Milgram was on the mattress. Mr. Milgram was at the one table, seated in the only chair, doing things with his pills and bottles. There was a large purple welt on the side of his neck. It looked like an eggplant. Janina was laughing. What's so funny? I said. You, she pointed. You peed yourself. I looked down. The front of my pants was soaked. It was the juice from the fish chunks in my pockets. I have food, I announced proudly. I pulled the fish chunks from my pockets and put them on the table. Uncle Shepsel picked one up. He sniffed it. Pickled herring. I saw Mrs. Milgram's head rise from the mattress. Uncle Shepsel devoured his piece at once. Mr. Milgram and Janina each grabbed a piece and took it over to Mrs. Milgram. They laughed, seeing they were both doing the same thing. Mr. Milgram pulled Janina's head into his chest. I'll see to Mother, he said. Janina held her fish chunk up to the light bulb. The skin on one side was silvery. She turned the chunk over and over, studying it. Then she licked it as if it were a taffy, each side of it. Finally, she bit off a little piece with her front teeth. As she chewed, she closed her eyes and smiled dreamily. It took her a long time to finish it. There were only chewing sounds as they ate their chunks of pickled herring. Everyone wore coats and hats and scarves, but all had taken off their gloves, the better to feel the fish. Their frozen breaths clouded the waxy smear of light. When the last chunk was gone, Janina pointed at me. She looked angry. You didn't eat! I was starting to explain that I had had a chunk before I arrived, when the sound of a machine gun peppered the night. It was very near.
Then there were screams and thuds and running feet and shouts, "Out! Out!"
Uncle Shepsel stood in the middle of the room and raised his hands and shouted to the ceiling, "This is it! It's over! This is it!" "Shut up!" said Mr. Milgram as he helped his wife up from the mattress. Janina gaped at the door. It was bedlam on the other side.
"Open the door," said Mr. Milgram calmly, "before they come in for us."
Uncle Shepsel continued to scream at the ceiling, "This is it! This is it!" I was about to open the door when Mr. Milgram said, "No, wait."
Slumped against one wall was a large, stuffed cloth bag embroidered in black and green designs. Mr. Milgram reached into the bag and pulled out a blue and white armband. He slipped it over my coat sleeve onto my right arm. "I got this for you," he said. I opened the door. People were stampeding by, tumbling down the stairs, screams, shattering glass, gunshots. We made our way down to the ground floor. Janina squeezed my hand. I could feel her trembling. Bright lights flooded the courtyard. I shielded my eyes. Janina nudged closer to me. Voices shrieked out of the blinding lights. "Move! Move, all you filthy sons of Abraham! All you stinking Zionists! All you dirty Jewish pigs! Line up! Line up!" Lines were forming, like a company of soldiers. I thought, maybe we're going to be in a parade. We found places. We stood.
"Silence! Silence, you filthy swine!" Mr. Milgram whispered.
"Stand straight. Look healthy." I heard Mrs. Milgram groan. As we were lining up, snow began to fall. The flakes were fat and starry in the blinding lights.
"Stand at attention," Mr. Milgram whispered.
I didn't pay him much mind. He had no way of knowing how impossible it was for me to stand still. I had never stood still for more than 5 seconds in my life. Nevertheless, I tried. Mr. Milgram was on one side of me, Janina on the other. The soldiers screamed. With my new armband, I thought, I am a Jew now, a filthy son of Abraham. They're screaming at me. I am somebody. I tried to listen well, to hear what they were screaming, but I could not understand much beyond dirty and filthy and Jew. Something happened up front. The screams got even louder, screechier. I heard a hollow thudding, "Fuck!" as if someone were knocking wood. I leaned to the side, trying to see past the column of people in front of me. Mr. Milgram jerked me back. "Attention!" I was beginning to get the message. Standing at attention was very important. Perhaps someone up front wasn't doing it right. I accepted the challenge. "You want attention? I'll give you attention." I had seen many jackboots stand at attention. I straightened my spine, snapped my heels together, lifted my chin, stared at the back in front of me. I gave them the best attention there ever was. As the screaming went on, I assumed that others were not so good at this as I. The back I stared at was green. A lady with a green coat. Snow kept falling. Sometimes a flake tickled my nose. I did not twitch. I did not move my eyes. I barely breathed. Flake by flake, the green shoulders of the lady turned white. Somewhere up front, a baby began to scream. Then another to the right. Then another. The louder the baby screamed, the brighter the lights.
"Jew dogs! Filthy swine! Fuck! Fuck!"
Jackboots and flops came through the lines, screaming into the people's faces, poking them with clubs and rifles, spitting in their faces. A jackboot stopped in front of Mrs. Milgram. I could see from the corner of my eye. He screamed at her. She fell to the ground.
"Get up! Jew dog! Filthy sow! Get up!" he screamed.
If he wants her to get up, I thought, why is he kicking and clubbing her? I didn't understand. At last, Mr. Milgram managed to pull her to her feet. The jackboot passed by me and Janina. I think he looked at me, but I could not see his face for the blinding lights behind him. For an instant, I felt proud, as if he had pinned a medal on me for standing at attention so well. When he came to Uncle Shepsel, he growled, "Open your mouth." I heard Uncle Shepsel give a whimpering, "Oh." He must have opened his mouth, for I saw the muzzle of a rifle come forward. I couldn't stand it any longer. I turned my head to see. I saw the muzzle go into Uncle Shepsel's mouth and push. Uncle Shepsel went backward into the lady behind him, who in turn fell back into the man behind her, and so forth,
as the whole column of people toppled over. The jackboot laughed. I went back to attention. I didn't want that to happen to me. I had known from the start that the green-coated lady in front of me was in trouble. Her attention was very poor. She wavered from side to side. Sometimes her head drooped, and her shoulders were not straight at all. When a jackboot came to her, he must have seen it also. Down came a club. Fuck! Then another bash across her chest. The snow went flying from her shoulders into my face. I hoped the jackboot noticed that I didn't move. It wasn't long before the lady's shoulders were white again. Her head was drooping all the time now. I could hear her sniveling. The next time a jackboot came to her, he said, "You stinking sow! You smell like a pig farm." He clubbed her again, and again the snow flew from her shoulders. Then it seemed all the jackboots were telling the people how bad they smelled. They were holding their noses. I was shocked. I had thought I was the only one who smelled bad. I sniffed, and I began to smell it myself. I was aware of tiny yips and whimpers erupting around me. I knew what the smell was, but despite what the jackboots said, there were really no pigs and therefore no pig flop in the courtyard. And then I felt, down under my stomach, the urge to go, and I understood what was happening. We had been standing there for a very long time, and people were having to go, and there was no place to go but where we were standing. And so people just relieved themselves where they were. And I heard the sad shudders as it ran down their legs and into the snow. And when I couldn't hold my own any longer, I did the same. And even then I remained at such splendid attention, I was tempted to call out to the jackboots, "Hey, look at me!" The screaming never stopped. By now people were falling all over the courtyard, falling and staggering to their feet and falling again. It was easy to tell the people who had not fallen. They were the ones with the highest piles of snow on their shoulders and heads. I could now feel the faint weight of the snow on my head. I wondered how it looked. I took even more pains not to move. I didn't want my snow to fall off. I thought of the stone angel. I pictured the snow falling over it, two crests of snow rising on the tops of its wings. So silent, the both of them, the angel and the snow. I pretended I was the stone angel. I closed my eyes and pretended as hard as I could, and after a while, I was convinced I could feel wings sprouting from my shoulders. I wanted to look, to see my wings, but I was an angel of stone, so I could not move. Next thing I knew, my face was in the snow, and Mr. Milgram and Janina were hauling me to my feet. "What happened?" I said. Mr. Milgram smacked me. "Quiet! They'll beat you. You fainted. You're too stiff. Bend your knees a little bit." This was all getting complicated, not to mention very tiring. I was supposed to move, but not move. I tried. I bent my knees. Jackboots screamed, babies screamed, lights screamed. We stood so long, my pants dried out. When they finally let us go, the sky was turning gray above the rooftops. We lurched across the snow. Mobs stampeded for the bathrooms. There was one on each floor. I myself did not understand bathrooms. I had never used one, never needed one. The world was my bathroom. I dragged myself up the stairs with the Milgrams. Uncle Shepsel and Mrs. Milgram performed a groaning duet that grew louder with each step. I followed them into the room. I wanted only to sleep. I collapsed onto the floor. When I awoke, I thought I was back in the courtyard under the blinding lights, but it was only the sun in the window. And Uncle Shepsel, propped on his elbow, was pointing at me and saying, "Why is he sleeping here? He smells." "I regret to inform you," said Mr. Milgram, "that you are not a rose garden yourself these days." Uncle Shepsel pounded the floor. "He's not family." Mr. Milgram looked straight at him. "He is now." 21. Kuba lifted the newspaper. "He's dead." "Kaput," said Enos. We were standing in the snow around the body of John. I wasn't sure how they could tell. John was no grayer, no more silent than usual. Other people walked by, not looking. Shoes, said Ferdy. John had fine shoes like the rest of us, except Big Henrik. When one pair wore out, we stole another. Somebody will take them, said Ines.
But it's John, said Oleg.
He meant to point to John, but only his shoulder moved forward. Sometimes Oleg forgot his right arm was gone. Give them to Big Henrik, Uri's voice. He hadn't been there a moment ago.
Big Henrik doesn't like shoes, I said.
This was true. Even before the ghetto, even before the jackboots came, Big Henrik wore gray bank coin bags on his feet. Even in the snow, they were tied at his ankles with drawstrings.
They won't fit, said Ferdy.
I couldn't tell if Ferdy's cloud breath was from the cold or his cigar. Big Henrik has little feet, said Uri. Take them off.
Kuba pulled off John's shoes. Uri swiped away snow with his foot. He made Big Henrik sit on the curb. He pulled off Big Henrik's bank bags.
He put John's shoes on Big Henrik and tied them tight. Big Henrik stomped his feet like a baby. He let out a loud squawk. Uri grabbed Big Henrik's ears and twisted. I thought he was going to twist them off. Big Henrik's eyes bugged out. Using the ears as handles, Uri hauled Big Henrik to his feet. He let Big Henrik squawk some more, then said to him, "Are you going to wear the shoes?" Big Henrik nodded sharply. Uri let go. As we were walking away, I said to Uri, "Will an angel come for John?" This is what I had heard under the braided rug, that when you die, an angel carries you off to a place called heaven. Ines, overhearing, sneered, "Yeah, here comes the angel." It was a horse, so skinny it seemed made of sticks and paper bags, clopping through the snow and slush of the street. It was led by two bedraggled men, and it pulled a wagon with a dead and naked body on it. We looked back. The horse stopped at John. One of the men grabbed John by his feet and pulled him to the wagon. The other man grabbed John by his armpits, and together they swung him back and forth. It reminded me of the girl orphans jumping rope. Suddenly they let go of John, and he sailed through the air to the top of the other body. The wagon rolled on.
"Where are they taking him?" I said.
"Where do you think?" said Ines. "Off to heaven he goes."
I believed him. "What happens there?" I said.
Kuba laughed. "He becomes a jackboot."
Others laughed loudly, even Uri. I was confused.
"But he's dead."
"Not anymore," said Ferdy. "Nobody is dead in heaven, right, Uri?" said Kuba.
Everyone looked at Uri. Uri said nothing.
"They pump the air back into you and you're good as new," said Kuba.
More laughter. Ines raised his fists. "Let's hear it for heaven." Everyone cheered but Uri, even Big Henrik, and then we were silent for a long time. The only sound came from Big Henrik trying out his new shoes, clopping them like a horse into the slush and snow. When he splattered the ankles of other people, they gave us ugly looks. Someone gave us more than that. A flop. Flops were all over the place. The jackboots hired them to guard the Jews in the ghetto. The crazy thing was, the flops were Jews too. Jews guarding Jews. It made no sense to me. Flops were not allowed to carry guns, but each had a whistle and a wooden club as long as my arm. They wore uniforms, but they fit no better than our clothes. No high boots, no silver eagles. And of course, being Jews, they wore armbands. So this flop came along and began to yell, shaking his club, "Armbands! Armbands!" As always, at times like that, we scattered like cockroaches. But this time one of us got caught. Big Henrik. Big Henrik was clopping away in his new shoes and did not notice anything else until the flop had him by the arm. I heard a bellow and stopped to look back. Big Henrik was standing in front of the flop, holding his head with both hands, while the flop screamed at him and waved the club in his face. The flop was short and scrawny. He had to look up at Big Henrik as he screamed at him. Then I saw a flash of red hair. It was Uri coming up behind the flop. He grabbed the club and pulled the flop over backward to the sidewalk. By now the rest of the people were on the other side of the street, pretending they didn't see. Now the club was in Uri's hands, and Big Henrik was just standing there watching, And that was when Uri conked the flop on the top of his head, just like that. Fuck! Like the sounds in the lineup. Now it was the flop holding his head, wobbling about the sidewalk. This must have tickled Big Henrik, for he took the club from Uri and bopped himself in the head. That must have tickled the rest of us, for suddenly we were all dashing out of our shadows, passing the club around, bopping ourselves in the head just hard enough to be fun, and send us lurching around the wobbling flop. When the flop lost his balance and toppled to the ground, we got other notions. We pulled off his shoes and flung them into the street, and all the people on the other side suddenly had eyes and dove for the shoes. And then the flop's jacket went flying, and then his pants. "Take his feet," Uri said to Enos. And Enos took his feet, and Uri took his arms, and I was having too much fun to think, "Uri, you're not being invisible." They swung him like a jump rope, like the wagon men had swung dead John, and let him fly, and the flop went sailing through the air, landing in a slushy splash. Uri wound up and flung the club far into the rubble, and the flop groaned in the snow in his underwear. And once again, there were no eyes on the other side of the street. 22. Spring. "Here comes the big shot," said grim-faced Ines.
"The new Jew," said Kuba the clown.
"The family man," said Ferdy. His cigar flapped in his mouth as he spoke.
"The littlest Jew," said Ines.
"We are honored by your presence." He stood and bowed to me. Uri smiled. I no longer slept all the time with the boys. Sometimes, over Uncle Shepsel's objections, I slept at the Milgrams. When I returned to sleep with the boys, they ribbed me. There were mountains of rubble to climb over to reach the braided rug. We slept on top of it now. It was spring. From the moment Mr. Milgram said, "He is now," my identity as a gypsy vanished. Gone were the 7 wagons, 7 brothers, 5 sisters, Greta the speckled mare. Deep down, I guess I had always known my gypsy history was merely Uri's story, not reality. I didn't miss it. When you own nothing, it's easy to let things go. I supposed my last name was Milgram now, so Pilsudski went too. I kept Misha. I liked it. I kept something else too, the yellow stone around my neck. The yellow stone my father had given me. I knew, as something in me had always known, that that was the one true part of Uri's story. We lounged on the rug, on our backs, our hands behind our heads, taking it easy, enjoying the mild air, watching the stars fade. Soon there was only the moon and 1 star. A smear of robin's egg blue showed beyond the rubble. Day was coming. We were night people now. We were all smugglers now, even Big Henrik. Smuggling was a nighttime thing. Ferdy passed around his cigar. We took turns puffing and coughing. The stars were fuzzy beyond the cigar smoke. "Himmler coming!" These words were followed by the silence of surprise, as they were spoken by Big Henrik, who often bellowed like a cow, but hardly ever bellowed words. At last Ines said, "Himmler? The Himmler?"
"Himmler coming!"
Big Henrik repeated. "I don't believe it," said Ines. "Why is he coming?" said one-armed Oleg. Ines asked Uri, "What do you think?" Uri had the cigar. He blew a stream of smoke at the stars. "I think Himmler can go anywhere he wants." "Who's Himmler?" I said. Ines laughed. "Just the number 2 jackboot, that's all," said Kuba, who had taken a seat on a pile of bricks. "You can thank Himmler for this wonderful bedroom," said Ines, "and for the growl in your stomach, and the bodies in the streets, and the wall."
"Himmler Schmimmler," said Kuba.
"We're as good as dead," said Ines.
"Himmler coming,"
bellowed Henrik. The sun came up, and we went to sleep. We woke at noon and scattered. I looked for Himmler everywhere. I didn't see him. I was disappointed. I wanted to get a look at the number 2 jackboot. I had heard of a man called Hitler, who was boss of all the jackboots, who were also called Nazis. But it was Himmler, Ines said, who was in charge of the ghetto, in charge of the Jews, in charge of us. I usually brought food to the Milgrams. This time it was news. "Himmler is coming," I announced. After giving me his greeting, "Ah, the smelly intruder," Uncle Shepsel looked me over and said, "Where's the food?" Mr. Milgram was lancing a boil on his wife's leg. A little gratitude would be nice.
I hate Himmler, said Janina. She was playing pickup sticks on the floor. She had brought them from the old house.
Don't you want to see him?
I said. If I see him, she said, I'm going to go right up and kick him. To show me, she stood and kicked the leg of the table.
Who says he's coming? Said Uncle Shepsel.
Big Henrik, I said.
Who's Big Henrik?
He's big, I said. He didn't used to wear shoes. Now he wears dead Johns.
I'll stop there, said Uncle Shepsel. Are you going for food?
Not now, I said.
I'm hungry now.
Mr. Milgram snapped,
Shepsel!
Uncle Shepsel slunk back into his usual corner. Mr. Milgram finished with the boil and pulled Mrs. Milgram up to a sitting position, her back against the wall. She had become skinny and gray. She no longer worked at the uniform factory. She tilted to one side. Her hair was like a mop. She looked like rag dolls I had seen Dr. Korchak's orphan girls carry. She coughed, and the force of the cough toppled her over. Mr. Milgram straightened her up again. He pushed himself to his feet. He shuffled across the room to me. I knew he was going to talk to me. He seemed to feel he had to be close to me in order to speak. And he never spoke without touching me. Sometimes he laid his hand on my head. Sometimes he ran his fingertip across my shoulder. He did this with Janina, too. And he always smiled when he spoke to us. You're a good boy, he said. I was sure he was about to praise me more, but Janina interrupted. Am I a good girl? She said, pressing up to his leg. He laid his other hand on her head. You are both good. You are the best children. But who's better, said Janina, Misha or me? Mr. Milgram looked down on us. His smile seemed to double, so we would both have a full share. He pretended to give the question great thought. No one is better, he said at last. It's a tie.
Janina stomped her foot. Tata, it can't be a tie. Somebody has to be better.
Who says? Said her father.
Tata, I beat Misha all the time when we race.
This was a lie. It was I who always won. Janina lied a lot. And I'm better at pickup sticks.
True.
And look! She did a split. And look! She attempted a handstand. For a few seconds, her feet hung in the air, inches above the floor. Her shoes were caked with spring mud, crusty and torn. The shoes came back down. She stood proudly. See? In her mind, she had done a magnificent feat. I can do that for a whole hour if I want to.
Mr. Milgram nodded. Very impressive. It's still a tie.
Janina stomped. She squealed. Mr. Milgram raised his finger. She stopped squealing. She started again when he put his finger down. He raised it again. She stopped.
But Tata, you said I'm wonderful. Remember you said that?
I remember, he said. And I meant it. Janina stuck out her tongue at me. I'm wonderful. And so is he, said Mr. Milgram. But I'm more wonderful, right, Tata?
You are both equally wonderful, said Mr. Milgram. You are each wonderful in your own way.
What way am I wonderful, Tata? He sat down with a sigh in the only chair. He was always tired. He was no longer smiling, and yet it felt somehow as if he was.
You, he pressed the tip of her nose with his finger, are girl wonderful, and he is boy wonderful.
Janina looked at me. She was the only person I knew who had to look up at me. She studied me. She turned back to her father.
But girl wonderful is better than boy wonderful, yes, Tata?
Mr. Milgram slumped in the chair. He wagged his head. He turned Janina around by her shoulders and gave her a gentle pat on the backside. Go play pickup sticks with Misha, he said. We had just sat down cross-legged on the floor, the pickup sticks between us, when we heard voices in the courtyard. I couldn't make out what they were saying. I went to the window and leaned out. Now I could hear.
Himmler's coming!
23. Janina was screaming as I raced down the stairs to the courtyard and the street. She wanted to kick Himmler, and it took both her father and Uncle Shepsel to hold her back. I careened from person to person. Where is Himmler? Where is Himmler? I followed pointing fingers down one street and another until I saw the cars coming. A parade of them. Huge cars. Magnificent cars, with the tops down. The cars had uniforms of their own. They were gray and silver and unsmiling and proud, like the men sitting in them. Pedal carts veered out of the way. I was surprised that people were not pouring out of the buildings, mobbing the sidewalks. A few people stood at the curb, hats in hand, looking down. Others kept walking along, eyes straight ahead. Such was a man whose sleeve I tugged. Which one is Himmler? The man kept moving as if I wasn't there. Only the flops looked at the parade. They stood at attention with one arm outthrust in the jackboot salute, as if reaching for something no one else could see. A corner of newspaper over a nearby corpse waved in the breeze. I began to panic. I grabbed at people. Which one is Himmler? No one would answer. I trotted along with the cars. I stared at the magnificent men. They stared straight ahead. On their jackboot hats, the great silver eagles spread their wings and seemed to glare at the people, daring them to do something wrong. Their wings were like angels' wings, except the eagles' wings were fully unfurled, flying. I began calling to the men in the cars, "Are you Herr Himmler?" Some of the men looked down at me. No one answered. I ran from car to car. "Are you Herr Himmler?" I saw a man, the most magnificent jackboot I had ever seen, sitting in the back seat of the first car. It must be him. His ramrod attention was better than my own in the courtyard, and he was only sitting. Blonde hair curled from beneath his eagle-winged hat. His head looked as if it had been chiseled from stone. His jawbone was all the weapon he would ever need. "Herr Himmler!" I shouted. "Herr Himmler!" He did not move. But someone else did. The jackboot in the passenger side of the front seat turned his head slightly, enough so that one of his eyes stared at me for a moment. The eyes seemed too large, as it was magnified behind the thick, round lens of his eyeglasses. The only thing magnificent about this man was his uniform. I saw half a little black mustache. It seemed to be dripping out of his nostril, a scrawny neck, a head that seemed more dumpling than stone. Can this be Himmler, the number two jackboot? He couldn't be. He'd looked like Uncle Shepsel. I knew how to prove it one way or the other. His boots. Surely on the feet of Himmler, master of all the Jews, would be the most magnificent boots of all. Maybe they went all the way up his legs. Maybe they had silver eagles. The parade was picking up speed. I ran to keep up. "Herr Sir, let me see your boots. Herr Sir." And suddenly I was on the ground. I had run smack into someone. As I got to my feet, a club was swinging back and forth before my eyes. I heard a loud smacking kiss. There was an overpowering smell of mint. Beyond the swinging club, the parade rolled through an open gate in the wall and was gone. I knew who was on the other end of the club. I looked up. It was Buffo. Buffo was the worst flop of all. He was the only one I was really afraid of. We all were. No one knew how to account for an existence like Buffo's. It did not seem that he could possibly be a Jew, but then he wasn't a jackboot either. We boys decided to believe he was a Warsaw sausage maker. He looked like a pile of fat sausages, who hated Jews so much that he pretended to be one so that he could live in the ghetto. Then he could become a flop and torment Jews to his heart's content. Like all flops, Buffo was not allowed to carry a gun. But that made no difference to him. He would not have shot anyone if he could. He carried only his club. It was said that he loved the sound of his club cracking open a skull like a pumpkin. But this was not true. He hardly ever used his club. His real weapons were his hands. More than anything, he loved killing Jews with his hands. And not just any Jews. Jewish children. If you were an adult Jew, he would walk right past you. But he went out of his way for children. Sometimes he left the streets and waddled through the alleyways and rubble, smacking the club on his thigh, hunting. When he spotted someone to go after, he kissed the club. Fortunately, he was fat and slow. If he managed to catch you or trick you, he used the club to stun you. Then he jammed it into his belt and waggled his fingers for the treat to come. He always smelled of mint, not from chewing gum or candy, from mint leaves. He chewed them like some men chewed tobacco. There were always tiny flecks of mint on his lips. If you could see them, and if you could smell the mint, you knew you were too close. In fact, that was how we came to say a child was killed by Buffo. He smelled the mint. His favorite way to kill you was to pull you face first into his bottomless belly and smother you. When this happened, the odor of mint hovered about the body until the wagon came to cart it away. I think Buffo hated me most of all. I was the only one who ever got close enough to smell the mint and lived to tell of it. Though he terrified me, I pestered him. I couldn't help myself. I called him Fat Man. I had no sense. If I had had sense, I would have known what all the other children knew. The best defense against Buffo was invisibility. Never let him see you. Me? If I saw him waddling down the street, I would sneak up behind him and yell, "Fat Man!" He would be fuming as he turned around, for he recognized my voice, his personal gnat, and the club would already be swinging, and I would be ducking out of the way. "Your ears are hairy!" I would shout, and thumb my nose at him and scoot away into the crowd. And now, here he was, looming above me, smiling, and kissing his club. And that was giving me all the time I needed to get away, but I couldn't. He had my foot pinned to the ground with his boot, a scuffed, mud-caked, unjack-like boot. I screamed in pain. He laughed. The club clattered to the street. He wasn't going to use it. He was going to drown me in his belly. His meaty hands gripped my shoulders. I was dizzy with mint. My nose sank into his belly. And suddenly I was loose. I had yanked myself out of the shoe he had pinned to the ground, and now I was running, bouncing off people. When it was safe to stop, I sat on a curb. I had foiled Buffo again. I was alive. I took the other shoe off and threw it away. It was spring. When the cold came back, I would steal another pair. That night, on the rug, I laughed as I told the other boys about my close call with Buffo. Uri did not laugh. He said, "Don't."
"Don't what?"
I said. "Don't bait Buffo."
"Why?"
I said. He smacked me, hard, 3 times. "Don't," he repeated. The rest of the boys were silent. I turned away and whimpered myself to sleep. I never mentioned the man who could not have been Himmler. 24. "Find the cow," Dr. Korchak had said. It was the only time Dr. Korchak was ever stern with me. Whenever I brought him food for the orphans from the other side of the wall, he received it happily and patted me on the head and said, "My little smuggler." And as I turned to go, he never failed to say, "Be careful." Then, one day, he added, "Find the cow." From then on, every time I saw him, "Find the cow." The cow had become something to believe in or not to believe in, like angels, mothers, oranges. How could something as large as a cow live in the ghetto and not be seen? How could it survive? What would it eat? Rubble dust? And yet so great was the cry for milk for children that the cow seemed to materialize from the very hunger of the people, until one could almost see the animal loping down the street. Of course, no one really did see it, and the more we did not see it, the more we believed in it. Almost every day someone claimed to have heard a mysterious moo. Of course, the day soon came when Janina said she heard it.
"No, you didn't,"
I said, just to be contrary. Janina was always making things up.
"I did,"
she said. We were playing pick-up sticks. She swept the sticks away. "You're being a baby," I said.
"You're being a poop,"
she said. Uncle Shepso looked up from the book he was reading and growled at Janina, "There's no cow." Reading the new book he had found was all Uncle Shepsel did these days. When he reached the end of the book, he went back to the first page and started again. He muttered under his breath as he read. It was a book about the Lutherans. he was teaching himself to be one. Then he would no longer be a Jew, and they would let him out of the ghetto. Mr. Milgram told him, "You cannot stop being a Jew." Uncle Shepsel said, "I've already stopped. I'm a Lutheran." When Uncle Shepsel growled at Janina that there was no cow, I switched to her side. "Yes, there is," I said. "I heard it too." Until then, I had been uncertain. From that moment on, I believed in the cow. I had done this before. It seemed I believed whatever I heard myself say. A few days later, when Dr. Korchak first said, "Find the cow," my belief was confirmed. I could not find the cow. I looked all over. Courtyards, backyards, cellars, rubble. No cow. No moo. "I can't find the cow," I complained to the boys one day.
"That's because there is no cow, stupid," said Inas. Big Henrik bellowed, "No cow."
Kuba climbed up Big Henrik and sat on one of his shoulders.
"I'll bet Big Henrik is lying," he said.
Kuba leaned down so that his face was upside down in front of Big Henrik's.
"Big Henrik, do you believe there's a cow?"
Big Henrik swayed under the weight of Kuba. "Yes," he said. We all laughed because we knew his answer proved nothing. Big Henrik was not only the biggest boy, but also the most agreeable. He said yes to everything. This was our signal to play the Big Henrik game.
"Big Henrik, do you believe you're the biggest, dumbest person in the whole wide world?"
"Yes."
"Big Henrik, do you believe you're a little itty-bitty baby?"
"Yes."
"Big Henrik, are we going to sleep in a castle tonight in big soft beds and eat all the chocolates we want and the jackboots will be our servants?"
"Yes."
"Ask him if he believes in Buffo," said Ines. "Or Himmler."
"Big Henrik, do you believe in Himmler?"
I butted in. "I don't," I said. "There is no Himmler." And I told them at last about the parade of magnificent cars and how I called and called Himmler's name. And the only one who turned was the chicken-looking man in the front seat, turning one eye to stare at me behind the eyeglass.
"That was Himmler,"
said Uri.
"He can't be," I said. "He looks like my Uncle Shepsel."
"It's him," said Uri. "So Himmler, number two boss jackboot, master of all Jews, not to mention gypsies, was a one-eyed chicken." At that moment, I began losing respect for jackboots. I no longer wanted to be one.
25. Summer. There were no longer bows in Janina's hair or socks on her feet. The straps on her shoes were broken and flapped when she walked. The shoes had become muddy scraps. For a while I tried to shine them with spit, but the mud was too much. The best reflection I had ever seen of myself disappeared with the shine of her shoes. Janina cried a lot, and kicked, and screamed. Sometimes she screamed at her mother,
"Mama, Mama, make me a pickled egg! Make me! Make me!"
She loved pickled eggs more than anything, she said. But her mother only lay with her back to the room on the mattress in the corner. As much as Janina cried, she laughed too. But she didn't just laugh. She howled. Especially when I told her that Himmler looked like Uncle Shepsel. We were sitting on the floor picking each other's lice at the time, and Uncle Shepsel had just said, "You look like monkeys." And I had whispered to Janina, "Himmler looks like Uncle Shepsel." And Janina burst out laughing so hard she fell backward and knocked her head on the floor, and lice flew from her hair, and the head knock really hurt, and Janina didn't know whether to laugh or cry. So she did both. One day Janina ran to me in the courtyard. "I found the cow!" she screamed and grabbed my hand, and we ran. She led me to a bombed-out ice cream shop. Two walls were still standing. On one of them hung a tilting picture of a cow. She often played such tricks on me. Once, she tricked me into lending her my yellow stone necklace. She wore it for days. When I asked for it back, she threw it over the wall. I couldn't believe it. I was so mad. I threw the bag of gifts she had left on the steps for me over the wall. She threw my cap over the wall. She had brought one toy animal with her from the other side, a blue and gold stuffed pig. She hid it. I found it and threw it over the wall. She said no.